From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. He doesn't crazy.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Jeff Wald, the former manager to stars from Sylvester Stallone to Crosby, Stills, and Nash, talks about how his staggering cocaine habit affected his career and almost killed him. But first, the Hollywood News banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I am joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, I don't know if you took time to check in on the end of Oprah and her long reign in syndicated television last week.
I had lots of time, and somehow I didn't quite get around to watching the last, like any episode of Oprah. I didn't get to see the last one either.
Well, so Oprah is not really leaving. It's a big change. There's obviously going to be a race to see who the new queen of daytime talk is going to be, if there is such a person. But meanwhile, she's going over to OWN at Discovery. She's not going to be gone for that long.
This kind of feels to me like the Frank Sinatra and Eagles goodbye concert tours. There seemed to be one every year, and they kept going on and on and on, and they never went away. Yeah, in some ways, it's the change of a business, that rather than being somebody who is working for somebody else, she's now taking all of her business, including her own identity, and creating a cable network out of it. So I guess we'll actually be seeing more of Oprah than we've ever seen before, but just in a different form.
Yeah, the Oprah Winfrey Network has been broadcasting since January, and it has a lot of female-oriented shows. Surprise, surprise. Finding Sarah, which hasn't premiered yet. That's with Sarah Ferguson. Why Not with Shania Twain, reality show, a talk show with her friend Gail King. But we haven't seen a ton of Oprah on this yet. And over on the executive side, there's just been a ton of turnover. Discovery keeps increasing the amount of money that it's putting in to get this thing up and running. It's $216 million and counting, I think, at this point. And Oprah has admitted that, you know, she's been busy with her own show, which is going to be in reruns on the network starting soon, and that she has not been able to focus on the network. She's been consulting with Lorne Michaels, who knows a little bit about TV, and he's told her that she will need at least 3 years to get this thing to work, and that may be optimistic.
No, and it sounds like it's one of those bad dilemmas where she has said that she wants to be involved in all aspects of the programming on her channel, and she hasn't had the time. So that's, I think, why it's been so slow to get going and why there's so few shows that have been introduced.
And, you know, you almost feel like, is this a bridge too far? I mean, you know, she did get involved with the previous network, Oxygen, and that didn't go that well. It's a tough thing to program a network, and we'll have to see how that turns out. Meanwhile, speaking of the fairest in the land, John, there is a duel which is getting to be kind of crazy between Universal and Relativity. They both have Snow White projects, film projects. I don't know. Are you finding it as inexplicable as I am?
Well, there's certain things that are always inexplicable about Hollywood, and that's how competing studios will come up with very similar movies around the same time. It happened with an Asteroid movie. It happened with a Wyatt Earp movie. It happened with a Lombada movie years ago. But what's happening here is almost a little bit more personal and catty. Relativity Media, which used to have a relationship with Universal, and Universal each have their own Snow White movies, and they keep dating one in front of the other. And the latest thing that happened is that Relativity took its Snow White movie, which stars Julia Roberts, and put it in front of Universal's Snow White movie, which stars Kristen Stewart.
I should say that Julia Roberts does not play Snow White, but the evil stepmother, because that might be confusing to some of our listeners.
And at the same time, Relativity put two other films right on top of Universal movies that would theoretically go after the same audience. So this is it's kind of a sandbox fight that is playing out very publicly. And none of these movies, we should say, have even started filming, and yet they're dating them, you know, really mere months from now. So who knows what's going to happen? And Relativity's Snow White film is supposed to start next month, where Universal's is supposed to start in August. But as always happens, when you're racing to make a movie and racing to make a date, usually bad things happen.
It makes you wonder whether one of them is going to fall by the board. So you think they're both going to go this time, huh?
No, I think that's the real issue. If Universal or even Relativity feels that they're going to be beat, maybe it's bad money, because it doesn't make sense that the audience could support two Snow White movies within such a narrow time period.
On a more amicable note, perhaps, Disney has decided to withdraw. They were going to try to trademark SEAL Team 6, obviously a reference to the people who got in there and did in Osama bin Laden. And the government seems to have an issue with Disney owning the trademark to that.
This is kind of a wonkish intellectual property debate, but I find it very interesting. Disney was proposing that it would trademark SEAL Team 6 and that it would put it on toys and games and snow globes and Christmas stockings.
Right.
And the Department of Defense said, not so fast. So it kind of brought up this interesting question of, like, you know, what can you trademark? And Disney historically has taken great advantage of formerly trademarked or copyright protected works that have entered the public domain. Tarzan, Fantasia, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Aladdin, Rapunzel. At the same time, they've been fiercely protective and have also gotten the government to extend the copyright protection of the works that are based on these public domain things. So in some ways, the tables have turned on Disney, which has always been very aggressive about protecting trademarks. And I think they went up against a foe in the U.S. government that was too tall. And I think a lot of people found it unseemly that they would try to take commercial advantage of American soldiers who killed Osama bin Laden.
I think Disney got the memo on that pretty fast. I mean, it was not fast enough to avoid being lampooned publicly in places like Jon Stewart's show. But I think, you know, when you consider not just the embarrassment of trying to trademark this, but, you know, Disney has Jerry Bruckheimer in Pirates of the Caribbean. Jerry Bruckheimer has famously very extensive connections to the military. They've cooperated on a lot of his films. And you can just imagine there were a lot of, or maybe just a few high-level phone calls, brief, to the point, and Disney got it.
No, and I think Disney will probably still end up trying to develop, if not make, a TV show based on Navy SEALs, but they will have to call it something very different.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can stay up to date with all the Hollywood news that's fit for bantering on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Addiction is not a new story in Hollywood, but today we're going to hear the harrowing details of how one man's drug habit affected his very successful life in the business and almost ended it altogether. I first met Jeff Wald back in the early 90s when I was working with Nancy Griffin on our book, Hit and Run, How John Peters and Peter Guber Took Sony for a Ride in Hollywood. Short and pugnacious, Wald told us such outrageous tales about his life as a talent manager in the 70s and 80s that I started pestering him to write a memoir. In the day, Wald had managed a huge array of stars, from Donna Summer and George Carlin to Sylvester Stallone and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He was also well known as the husband of singer Helen Reddy, whose anthem, I Am Woman, helped define the era. In Wald's heyday, drug use was an accepted and arguably even a necessary part of doing business in Hollywood. But Wald stood out in the crowd with a truly staggering cocaine habit. Wald was also hot-tempered and badly behaved. In 1980, he was arrested after shoving a shotgun into the mouth of a picketing hotel employee in Tahoe. After he split from Reddy in 1983, he tried to run over her boyfriend at the time in a $50,000 silver Maserati. The couple's custody fight over their son made the cover of People magazine. Despite it all, Wald maintained relationships with top figures in Hollywood and in politics, including Jerry Brown, Teddy Kennedy, and Gerald and Betty Ford. As you'll hear, Wald's wild ride almost came to a permanent end in 1986, when his drug abuse almost killed him. He's been sober ever since and happily married to his wife, Deborah, for more than 20 years. Wald hasn't gotten around to writing that memoir yet, but with all the Charlie Sheen talk in the air in recent weeks, I asked him whether he would talk about the impact of drugs on his life and career in Hollywood.
Well, I started smoking pot when I was 13, back in the Bronx. My whole neighborhood smoked. Nobody drank in my neighborhood, mainly because I think we grew up near an Irish bar and found nothing attractive about beating up your wife and vomiting. I sold marijuana in a William Morris mailroom. I mean, I was married and had a child and making $55 a week, taking home $99 every 2 weeks. So I supplemented. I was making about $300 a week selling pot.
In New York or in L.A.?
In New York, in New York. And I guess I started doing cocaine when I started making money in the music business. I guess I was about 19, 20. And I came to California in 1968. I was 24 years old. company called Campbell Silver Cosby, and immediately got lucky. But we managed Tiny Tim. So I went from no place to meeting Frank Sinatra and Rudy Valli. And, you know, we went to the Albert Hall in London, and the Beatles presented Tiny Tim live at the Albert Hall. And all the rock royalty was there. It was just a phenomenal, phenomenal time hanging out in Laurel Canyon with Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And, you know, in the 70s and late 60s and early 80s, it was common. Everybody was doing it. People you wouldn't believe were getting high. I mean, adults at that time, you know, people who were in their 60s and 70s. In this time, you can go to the old Spago on Sunset and see people who were marquee names of one sort or another getting high. So it was sort of a bonding thing. I've never hit it. I was very blatant about it. The only person I never got high near was Lou Wasserman and Edie.
Because?
Just because he was Lou Wasserman, you know what I mean? And it just, I knew it wouldn't play. Just about anybody else, senators, governors, didn't matter. It was just very, very common to get up in the morning, get high. Our housekeepers would roll for Helen and I. There'd be 10 joints in the morning next to each breakfast plate. And for me, 3 grams of coke that they'd cleaned the night before.
Sitting on the breakfast table.
Yeah, so just, and I used to keep it in my socks. The joints in my socks, like little bullets in a bandolero, you know.
So you were essentially high all the time.
I was high from the moment I got up in the morning until I went to bed at night. I mean, I started getting high at 13, stayed high until I was 42.
Okay, so this is before Helen had I Am Woman.
I Am Woman came in 1972. I came here in 68. And she got her record contract the end of 1970. Had her first hit in 71 with I Don't Know How to Love Him from Jesus Christ Superstar. And then I Am Woman reached number one December 12th, 1972. And the date sticks in my head because my son was born on that same day. We were on a nice roll, but I had George Carlin before that. I had the Deep Purple. I had the Turtles. I had a huge management company in the 70s. I had Donna Summer. I had Sylvester Stallone. Crosby, Stills, and Nash had in the 80s. I had Chicago in the 70s. I had Tom Skerritt, Jim Brolin, Elliot Gould.
So, I mean, you know, it was the 70s, the 80s. Everybody's getting high. But at some point, did you ever feel like you, in order to get or keep clients, doing drugs was part of that in that era?
Not to get or keep. It just became part of the social fabric, like having a, you know, instead of going out for a drink with somebody, you went and got high. You know, you did a toot, you did a one-on-one, you showed up at the set with some drugs, and everything was a party.
You know? I mean, if you had been sober at that time, would it have been weird?
You would have been sort of not what was current in Hollywood. And by the way, there was a period of time, a long period of time, where if you didn't get high, you were a Republican. You know,
I mean, did anybody come to you and say, you're high all the time, I don't want you to be my manager anymore?
Never. No, nobody ever. Most of them were getting high. I mean, Donna wasn't. But was never brought up about the drugs. So nobody, I mean, Brolin stayed with me. And Jim Brolin brought his second about-to-be wife to my house, Jan Smithers. And he came to my house in Malibu for breakfast with her. And I literally fell asleep in my eggs, my head right to sleep.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jeff Wald, who, starting in the 1970s, built a spectacular career managing stars like Donna Summer, Sylvester Stallone, and James Brolin. But by the mid-80s, Wald's addiction began affecting his relationships in the industry.
I guess it started about the end of 84. 84 was the beginning, I guess. It started to go negative on me. I started being abusive. I remember having, Jim was doing Hotel.
Jim Brolin.
Yeah, and we had a meeting set with Aaron Spelling. I got there an hour late, and Aaron was upset that I was an hour late, and I got in his face. I don't give a shit. What are you talking about? I'm an hour late. Big deal, you know? And it was behavior like that. I basically got into a thing with Stallone and blew him off, and I got in a thing with Donna Summer. So I started blowing these artists away. Helen and I got divorced. I started staying up all night and then sleeping during the day and not waking up and making appointments on time. I was living at the beach. Wasn't taking my son to school on time. Or if I did get him to school, I fell asleep in the parking lot or the teacher's parking lot in the car. I was not paying attention. I was too busy getting high and just not paying attention to business. And I overdosed on January 25th, 1986. my son's family. I was supposed to have breakfast with Ali McGraw at Patrick's Roadhouse. And my son came in to wake me up and tell me I was going to be late. Couldn't wake me up. My head was swollen. And called Ali. She said, well, call 911. I'll be right there. I lived in Malibu in the colony at the time. And she came there about the same time as the ambulance. Took me to Cedars Sinai, and I went underwent 7 hours of surgery. I had an infection behind my eyes. A pus the size of a fist behind my eye, just about to eat my brain. I was unconscious. I stayed unconscious after the surgery for almost 3 days. Joey Sugarman, who's a great doctor, who's one of those responsible, saved my life, said I was circling the drain. And see the scars where they literally removed the eyes to get at the infection. I had metal tubes coming out of my eyebrows, draining it. I remember Jane Fonda coming over. She came over with Troy, who was about my son's age, about 11 years old or something. I'm laying in the bed pontificating to him about how disgusting doing heroin is and whatever the hell it is. And I remember Jane said to me, "Was he disgusting?" She held the mirror up to my face.
So you were in pretty awful shape, and you had no idea.
None. I did not know that. I kind of sleep with a headache. I think I'd taken about 20 Advil or something, or Tylenol, whatever I had taken. Anyway, so I spent 17 days at Cedars Sinai. David Geffen and Carrie Fisher came and took me to my first AA meeting, which was in the building in Cedars Sinai. I'd never been to an AA meeting. Took me down there in a wheelchair, and I wanted to get out of there. But it was an act of kindness that they did that. I was there 17 days. I guess on the 16th day, I guess my son and Allie and my older daughter organized an intervention. And about 30 people in my room. You know, Leonard Goldberg was there. Jane Fonda was there. Ali McGraw was there. The Azoffs were there. It was a pretty... Norman Brokaw was there. And he would tell me how to go to Betty Ford. And I was pissed off and humiliated, embarrassed, basically cursing them all out. And who do they think they are coming and telling me this shit and embarrass me in front of my kids? And I'm not going to know Betty Ford. And Mrs. Ford, somebody had arranged Mrs. Ford to call up in the middle of this. And the president got on the phone. He wasn't president then, obviously, in 86. But he got on the phone and said, well, we could play golf after you finished. And Norman Brokaw stayed after everybody was gone.
And just at that time, he was like...
He was chairman of William Morris and a friend. And he said to me, what's the real reason you don't want to go to Betty Ford? And I said, well, I can't use the phone there, okay, because I'm about to run my business. And he said to me, there's no phones at Hillcrest Memorial. And whatever that hit, and I said, okay, you win. And it's a four-week program. And 2 weeks into it, I got called to Mrs. Ford's office, and she said, well, your 4 weeks is going to start now. And I flipped out. I said, what do you mean it's going to start now? I've been here 2 weeks. I have two more weeks. Big calendar, I'm crossing off the dates, right?
This is Betty Ford telling you this.
Yeah. She was there every day. And she said to me, well, the first 2 weeks she was suffering from terminal uniqueness. So it didn't count. Okay. She said, the truth is I've seen 1,000 of you come through here. And so I was feeling insulted and everything else. But it was an incredible, incredible thing. Saved my life.
So do you think you can go back and work? Like if you had just said, I'm going to stop using... Would that work?
On my own without going to Betty Ford or any of that? Never would have worked. I would have been dead. No question. There's no question that had I not gone through there and had that 6 weeks to pay attention only to that, no, I would have gone back out. I didn't know any other way to live.
Coming up after a short break, former talent manager Jeff Wald talks about rebuilding his life after he just about killed himself with cocaine, plus his take on drugs and Hollywood. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Drug addiction is nothing new in Hollywood, but today we hear about its toll from a player in the business who survived. We're talking with Jeff Wald, formerly manager to stars like Donna Summer and Sylvester Stallone. In 1986, his cocaine habit landed him first in Cedars Sinai on the brink of death and then at the Betty Ford Center. When he got out, he had to rebuild from the ground up.
It was very weird when I got out of Betty Ford because I had to learn the whole... I'd never driven a car sober in my life, and I had all this free time at traffic lights. It's traffic lights, I had a time that I can get the little vial out, I can unscrew it, I could do a one-in-one, wipe my nose in the mirror, screw the thing back, put it in my pocket, the light would change. Now I'm at the traffic light. I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll set my radio stations now. You know what I mean? Now I had all this time to kill. It left a big space in my time about scoring drugs, cleaning drugs, doing drugs. The first AA meeting I went to was on Rodeo in Beverly Hills. And that was also known as a good place for singles, and I was single at the time. And I'll never forget walking in there. I wore a sweatshirt with a hood and sunglasses, right? So nobody recognized me.
Unabomber look?
Basically, yeah. And I think I was like 3 feet into the meeting, about to sit down. Richard Dreyfuss stood on a chair and he said, "Wall, we've been waiting for you." You know, saved me a seat. But when I first got out, I'd been to a couple of people's houses where they broke out the cocaine in front of me. And two in particular, one was a somewhat of a television slash music star who told me if I didn't like it to leave, so I left. And the other was a very big-time producer and a huge movie star who basically gave me the same message. It's his house, and I don't have to do it like it. I stayed there because I liked those two guys. But I didn't go back, you know. And I stayed sober partly. My son, you know, I had to go to the bathroom with the door open. So nobody trusted me, you know what I mean? And there were some funny moments. About 6 months into my sobriety, I'd gone to a meeting with James Brolin, business meeting. And we got out of the meeting, we're standing by the elevator, and he's looking at me and looking at me, and finally says to me, "If you keep being so nice, you're going to f*** my career." You know, it's because I was bending over backwards to be Mr. Nice Guy after being sort of an arrogant f***. And so I had to find the balance, because it was scary, because I thought that a lot of my creativity came from the pot, you know, from the marijuana, because it always made me feel creative. And a lot of my energy and my arrogance too, but I guess my drive came from the cocaine, because, you know, I could be awake 20 hours or more, and I was pretty aggressive. But the curve to it is it always goes down to another side. It's just, there's no such thing as an old drug addict.
But do you see that Hollywood continues to enable all of these people, like the Charlie Sheens and the Lindsay Lohans and the others like them?
You know, the problem with, same thing with athletics, you know, athletes and in show business, we become millionaires very, very young. Most of us come from backgrounds with no money. So all of a sudden, from having nothing and just being another person out there, all of a sudden, the money in this country is worship. You become royalty. We don't have royalties. The royalty is money. And it opens the door. So you get the table in a restaurant, or you go to the head of the line, or you don't go online. Go around the back of Disneyland or something like that. And so you have a full sense of yourself and that you can get away with anything. And then most of the people around you, you're paying them salaries. So they're not telling you anything. So does Hollywood encourage it? I think that bad behavior is tolerated in this country by anybody with power.
You know, with Chris Farley, I know, just to name one example, you know, there were huge efforts made to intervene. And, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg was offering to take, I think he had a 24-hour babysitter monitoring Chris Farley, or because he was going to be originally going to be in Shrek. And they certainly tried similar things with some other stars that seems to be impossible if Hollywood does decide, if the industry decides to try to save someone who's valuable, maybe let's say even for the most cynical reasons, they don't seem to be too savable.
I'll tell you what I believe that is. And that is, unfortunately, again, with to do with money, there are rehab places that are just full of shit. So, you know, they're $30,000 a week or something, and one of the rehab places would let him out to go to my gym. Betty Ford, they didn't let you out. You were in there. There's no locks on your doors, and there was very stringent rules about what you could and could not do. Betty Ford's one of the most successful. So is Hazleton. In Minnesota. Betty Ford's based on the Hazleton principle. Same thing with Tucson, Sierra Tucson in Arizona, another really good one. So there are some good ones, but there are some ripoffs where they just take these people and coddle them. And Mrs. Ford didn't care that I had a movie opening or a client this or that. First of all, you had to be there, I think it was a week or 2 weeks before you could make one phone call. Then there was a payphone that you could use between 6 and 8, and your whole dormitory was able to use that phone. So you had a 2-hour window, I believe it was, for 20 guys. So go use that more than 5 minutes and see if you're not going to get punched out or somebody, you know, you had to learn to do all your business in 5 minutes. So it made a difference because they made you concentrate 100% on being sober. Now, when I first sat there the first 2 weeks, which obviously was noticed, I'm like, I'm counting the days. I've got a calendar. I'm making X's like I'm in jail. I can't wait to get out of this friggin' place. So I wasn't really listening to what they said. And they'd have people come in and said, I'm 20 years sober and I'm this and I'm that. And I think, please. And I'm thinking how boring it is. I'm 26 years sober now. 25, 1986 to now is, what is that? So it's 25 years sober. Who the hell ever thought I could do that? You know, and I don't miss it. Nothing. You know, I'm married now 20 years to the same person. I'm actually faithful. I got a great kid. I pay attention. I'm present. You know, I got a good relationship with my older children, which is, you know, God bless them for being so tolerant. And when I think back to some of the, you know, getting smoking grass in the car and with my kids in the car, I wouldn't dare do that now with my kid.
So when you see Charlie Sheen, for example, is he sober enough to go back and do his job?
He always did his job when he was screwed up, which is amazing. You know, so did I for a long time. But he put himself between a rock and a hard place. I think one of the things that makes me know he's sober or believe he's sober, besides the fact that he's willing to take drug tests, is that he does want his job back. And I think he is now really seeing, oh boy, I really screwed that up. How am I going to make $2 million a week in an episode? Okay, well, how am I going to replace that? How am I going to keep my startup? What's going to happen next to me? Because I was worried that anybody would talk to me or do anything, you know what I mean?
And you were worried?
Oh, terribly worried. I mean, I really was worried. I remember two people I'll never forget as long as I live. Stan Kamen, who was head of the William Morris Motion Picture Agency, terrific guy, real gentleman with real moral code, invited me to go to lunch after I got out of my Maison. I said, why would you want to be seen with me? So I'd been all over the Inquirer and whatever, and People Magazine. And he said, you were my friend before, and you're my friend again. And Teddy Kennedy was the other one. Teddy Kennedy came to town and said, let's go to lunch. And I said, what are you, stupid? You want to end your career with me? He said, you're my friend. You're always there when I needed something, and let's go to lunch.
God rest his soul, but I don't know that he ever got sobriety.
He didn't do drugs. He drank pretty good. I mean, he drank. He's Irish, you know. But he did. I think the end, Vicky got him sober, you know. I mean, that's part of it, too. He met a really good woman who took control. I mean, I say control. I don't mean dominated or anything. But it was worth it to him to honor her with that. My current wife, I'm faithful for the first time. You know, my other wives know I wasn't faithful. You know, it's about how you feel about somebody and then how that makes you feel about yourself.
Jeff Wald was a legendary talent manager in the 70s and 80s. We talked to him in his offices about addiction in Hollywood. A version of this interview appears in the latest issue of The Hollywood Reporter. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness or post on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. You can listen to us online at kcrw.com or on your phone with the KCRW iPhone and Android apps. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.